This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking with Professor Jane Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z, about a recent book she's translated from the French called Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you, Steve. It's an honor to be here.
Good to have you here. And tell us the correct way to pronounce the name of the author of Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. His first name is rather long.
His name begins with Abd, which a lot of Arab names begin with. Abd means the one who adores. So you have Abdullah, Abdul Fattah, many names that begin with that. So Abdul Wahhab literally means he who, you know, worships the one who is a gift giver, Wahhab. So that's sort of the key to all those names that begin with.
And his last name is Medeb, M-E-D-D-E-B. Abdul Wahhab Medeb.
Abdul Wahhab Medeb. And he, on many occasions, one time in his book Talismano, which I also translated. Which is a novel. He does a sort of riff on his own name because Medeb is based on the triliteral root edeb, which is literature, edeb. So a mu'edeb is, someone who does literature. And a meddeb in Tunisian dialect is a man, always a man, who teaches children to read the Quran. So his name contains all sorts of implications that he has very often played on in both his novels and his other writings.
Now, Professor Medeb is a professor in Paris and a literature professor, and he's originally from Tunisia, and he talks about, as a child in this book, how his father had him memorizing the Quran and how that influenced him. And yet at this point in his life, he's quite a secular person, although deeply very much a scholar of Islam and the Quran.
Exactly. He is sort of this Tunisian exception that people often talk about. People of his generation who were schooled in both the Quranic schools and the French secular schools. And he has this double education that he talks about in his book, which makes him a perfect bridge between the sort of hardline secularists and the conservatives who would have Tunisia sort of turn back to its more conservative roots. There aren't many like him anymore because it really was a very special juncture in Tunisian history. He was probably born in the 40s, I'm assuming, and anyone who was born in that period did benefit from a kind of double education. And those who were able to walk that tightrope really came out with an exceptional bilingualism and biculturalism that allows them to navigate what has turned into a very, very difficult situation in Tunisia and in many Arab countries in general.
Now, you spent some years in Tunisia. Tell us, tell listeners and me, a little bit about the country. First of all, it's in North Africa, right across from Italy, between what, Libya and?
Algeria. Right. It's depending on what point of view you take literally, you could talk about Tunisia as being just, a stepping stone away from Italy. It's easier to get to Naples than it is to most other cities in the south of Tunisia. I mean, it really is very, very close to Italy. And Tunisians feel that intuitively and even practically, it's a very easy place to get to by boat or flight. On the other hand, its neighbors to the east and west, Algeria and Libya, were, at least for the time that I was there, between the mid-70s and the early 90s, seemed very remote because, on the one hand, you had Colonel Gaddafi's Libya that was, if not hostile to Tunisia, then at least ambivalent in its relations. And Tunisians, other than those who lived in the Deep South, didn't really feel particularly connected to Libya. Algeria, on the other hand, I know a little bit better because I lived in a town right on the Algerian border when I was with the Peace Corps, which is the reason that I went in the first place. And I felt a certain Algerian-ness in the people that lived there on that border town. I, however, this was under Houari Boumediene, who was a staunch sort of Soviet-leaning socialist, would not allow Americans into the country. So while I was there until Boumediene passed away, I was not allowed to even pass over that border.
Oh.
So you can see that there was there were tensions. Bourguiba, the first president of Tunisia, was very anti-military. And there he was with two military leaders to the east and the west of him. And he was, you know, a very, very much a civilian a lawyer by training. He had none of these sort of Nasserist military leanings that are, as you know, are still plaguing Egypt right now.
And we want to talk about where things are in Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere in North Africa sometime in the program. But before we get to that, let's jump into this book a little bit. Would you be so kind as to read a passage where Professor Medeb is sort of describing his own early contact with the Quran?
Right. This is a passage at the beginning of the book where he's trying to explain that as a child, learning the Quran was almost like learning a foreign language. The Quran is, of course, in as classical an Arabic as you can imagine, which is not the Arabic that's spoken at home or in the street. And there are, it's a very beautiful, almost mysterious language. The Quran is miraculous in its poetry. And a young child, of course, can't begin to fathom what it actually means. So as he says, you know, he was walking through a dark forest with occasional clearings. That's how he felt when he was learning the Quran. He learned it by heart and only later as an adult understood it. This early contact with Quranic language endowed me with a penchant for what I call poetic reading. I favored a physical rapport with the language, whichever one it might be. I was attentive to its scansion, to the way the combination of vowels and consonants produced a musicality. I yielded to the overwhelming desire to return the text before my eyes to its oral origins, as if sound evinced sense. Whether voiced or graphically represented, a language acquires a holy status when the signifier takes precedence over the signified.
And what is a signifier?
Well, in linguistics, the signifier would be the word itself, and the signified is what it means. So he has a very, very interesting take on how the signifier, the letter or the word itself, especially in calligraphy, becomes separated from what it means. And I think all you have to do is look at some, you know, brilliant example of Andalusian calligraphy on the side of a mosque or a church to understand this. You can't literally read it. You don't know what it says, but you appreciate this calligraphy almost more as a work of art than as a word trying to communicate some kind of meaning. And he has spent, I think, a lifetime dealing with that that kind of beauty. And this is what he holds against current Islamists and the Wahhabiyin, especially in Saudi Arabia, who have focused more on the signified than on the signifier, that they want to divorce the beauty of the word from the what I would call the letter of the law. They seem to be more concerned with the letter of the law than with the what Meddib would call the unfathomable side of Quranic language.
And Meddib, in this book we're discussing that came out just this year from Fordham University Press, Islam and the Challenge of Civilization, Meddib doesn't hesitate to refer to these people as fundamentalists, as literalists, and to, from his perspective, as a modern person, a child of the Enlightenment, a professor in a major university in France, calling them to task for the problems that causes. And this book really tries to deal with that whole issue, I think, in a very, very enlightening way.
Exactly. What he's trying to demonstrate, and the book really is a long demonstration of this single fact, is that Islamism, and especially this Wahhabi Saudi brand of it, has nothing to do with original Islam, and especially with Islam when it reached its heights, its peak of cultural flourishing in Baghdad under the caliphs there, and in Andalusia in particular. He sees this manifestation of Islam as the true, the real Islam, and that this more austere, he uses the word austere whenever he talks about this Wahhabi, Saudi, Salafi, however you want to call it, brand of Islam that is sort of taking away the joy and the, especially anything having to do with saints or Sufism, as really depriving Islam of its most glorious past, cutting it off from its past.
Let's talk a little bit about the translation process. I was surprised, for example, when we were chatting earlier, that you have never met this author in person, nor even talked with him on the phone, even though you both speak French fluently. And you've traveled widely, and he's traveled widely all over the world. How did you get this job of translating? I know this is the second book of his you did. You did a novel of his, and I know you've done other novels from French to English. But how did you get this relationship?
Well, let me back up a little bit. Abdulhamid Meddib has a radio program, a weekly radio program, not unlike your own, Steve Shoemaker, which is called Cultures of Islam, Cultures of Islam, plural. And he insists on that. It's a weekly program that invites guests who are researching on any aspect of Islam that you can imagine, whether it be in the arts or in scholarly exegesis or you name it. I mean, and this has been going on for years. It really is a very, very interesting. So I feel like I know him. I've been listening to this program for a very long time, and I feel that I know him very well through that. As I was working through his two books, I communicated with him, thanks to the miracle of the internet, by email, and we had a very, very lively and personal email correspondence. So like so many other facets of life today, we can sometimes feel that we know someone even though we've never met face-to-face. I will be meeting him this winter in California when a teacher out there is going to be teaching Talismanu, which I translated. That's his novel. And he has, or she has invited me to be out there so that the two of us can have a dialogue together. And I'm looking very much forward to that. But to answer your original question of how I got onto this, Talismanu is a book that is almost impenetrable. I think you would agree with me that it's a very, very difficult novel to approach.
It's Joycean, could we say?
It is very Joycean, exactly. And I think he was probably greatly influenced. This was a book that was written in the 70s. It was the first thing he'd ever written. And as many first novels, he could never assume that there was going to be a second and a third. So he pretty much packed everything he knew into this book. And I don't think he would feel that I was insulting him if I said that he was probably taking some interesting drugs while he was writing this book, too, because it seemed, and he even talks about it in the novel, about traveling through Morocco and being under this influence. But it's not, you know, drugs for drugs' sake. It's to reach a higher plane of communication with the deity or whatever he wants to call it. It's in the sort of Sufi tradition of ecstasy. Ecstasy, small e, you know which one I'm talking about. So this was a book that I had first contacted when I was in Tunisia, didn't understand a word of it. I put it aside and...
You read it in French.
I read it in French, of course.
Sure.
And just didn't really know. I was still very young and hadn't had much experience in Tunisia yet and hadn't really done much literary analysis at that point. So I just put it aside. When I got to the University of Illinois to do my doctorate, many, many years later.
You did a master's first. Was that here or somewhere else?
A master's, and I did a combined master's and doctorate here at the University of Illinois. And I remembered that book, and I sought it out and got myself a copy and read it again, and it made all kinds of sense to me the second time around. And I thought, this is a book that Dalkey Archive Press, which is here at the University of Illinois, would probably love, because their purpose in life is to undertake the translation and publication of books that are formally challenging. It's not so much what the book is about as the way in which it is written in a sort of avant-garde way. And this
Now, you had already translated several other novels by other French
by other French authors.
For Dalkey Press.
Right, which were also in that same vein. They weren't just telling stories. They were doing interesting things on the page with, and this is something that I think the reading public has lost sight of. We tend to kind of read in order to melt into the story and forget ourselves rather than to be conscious of the interesting things that authors are doing on the page. But anyway, that's another subject. So I took it to the Dalkey Archive, and they were immediately seduced by it and told me to go to work, which I did. And it was...
Now, let me break in here. Now what is the relationship between a translator and a press when you're given this job? Do you get money up front? Are you paid for your time? Are you paid for the project? I know nothing about this whole thing.
Well, those things are always negotiable. With Dalkey, because they are a nonprofit press, they can't offer... what most big presses would be able to pay. That said, France is one of the countries of Europe that is willing to subsidize a part of translations into English, simply because if they didn't, many American publishers just wouldn't do it. And so part of what I am paid actually comes from the French government.
And were you also on the faculty of the University of Illinois at that time, or you were a graduate student, or what, when you first started doing the things for Dalkey Press here at the University of Illinois?
I believe when I first started, I was actually teaching. My teaching spanned, of course, all of those years that I was a graduate student, I taught, and then three or four years, I can't really remember. Beyond that, after I got my doctorate, I continued to teach for them.
In
the French department.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I was working on Talismano during that time. I would have to go back and check the dates.
We're talking about two books by Professor Medeb, M-E-D-D-E-B. I apologize for my stuffy pronunciation here. Talismano is the earlier book that was translated by Jane Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z. That's by Dalkey Archive Press here at the University of Illinois. And Islam and the Challenge of Civilization is the main topic for today here on Keeping the Faith, published by Fordham. Let's take a short break and hear about a program coming up here on AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Focus.
She's from Urbana, but author Jean Thompson's characters could be from anywhere in the U.S.
Her most recent novel, The Humanity Project, continues her examination of Americans who have been left behind, plus one eccentric philanthropist and her quest to get people to be good by paying them. Jean Thompson talks about her views on humanity and her approach to writing on an encore edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Tune in Monday morning at 10 on AM 580.
And I will admit that I'm going to be a guest on Focus 580, Focus a little bit later in the week. I think it's on Thursday at 10, and we're going to be talking about keeping the faith over the last several years for a half hour or so with Jim Meadows. So I'm looking forward to that. This is the next to the last Keeping the Faith program. Next week we'll be hearing an archive program that's been edited a little bit, an interview done by Stan Yanchis, one of the guest hosts for Keeping the Faith over the year. And he's asking questions to me and to another guest host, Don Nolan. So that'll be our last program, sort of looking back over the last 14 years of Keeping the Faith. I've enjoyed very much being the usual host of this program, partly because I've got to talk with some very interesting people, like our guest today, Jane Kuntz, and I've got to read some wonderful books, like this very interesting Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. Jane, you were saying when we were hearing that announcement about Focus tomorrow that you've read that book, or you know the author?
Jean Thompson's book, yeah. Yes. I highly, highly recommend The Humanity Project.
Ah, very good.
Giving a little plug for Jean, but it's just a wonderful book. She's a great, great writer.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about translating in this particular book on Islam. How much? Now, you lived in Tunisia for a total of how many years?
18 years.
You were surrounded by Islam, but did you have to study it to learn new things to be able to translate this book?
Well, I was lucky enough to have colleagues who love to talk and sit around and discuss. And it started around the early 80s when the rise of not Islam but Islamism, and I want to make those two things very separate, the rise of Islamism in Tunisia was beginning to pose problems. And we started noticing girls wearing veils and hardline students making demands that the more secular-leaning administrators were having trouble dealing with. So there was lots of discussion during those years about Islam, and one just assimilates it. When you live in a Muslim country, unless you live in some sort of Western enclave, it's everywhere. Maybe that is a difference between the Christian world and the Muslim world. Islam is just so much in the air, in people's way of talking and the choice of words, and it really is not that I was trying to avoid it, but it really is unavoidable. It's a topic of conversation constant, and there's so many holidays, Ramadan, the different Eids, the birth of the Prophet, Ashura. You know, your calendar year is punctuated by all of these different feasts that sort of bring the country to a stop, and people are thinking about religion, whether they practice it on a daily basis or not.
Were you worried when you were translating this book from the French about Islam that you were not yourself a Muslim?
You know, it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like to try to translate this book having absolutely no knowledge at all. It's just so much. I know the things I know. If I have some blind spots, maybe they'll show up. I would think, since I am only the translator and not the scholar who wrote the book, I can't be held to account for what Medib actually says. And believe me, he has been held to account. His hard line against the Islamists is not to everyone's liking, and he has been in debates.
Has he felt in danger personally, do you know?
His daughter has found herself in personal danger. His daughter is a journalist who was recently in Tunis covering some events there, and she was given a hard. She was in a tribunal. She was actually in a court covering what was going on there, and she shouted something out, and that got her in a lot of trouble. And I think she had a little bit of difficulty trying to get back. She probably has French nationality by this point. I'm sure she was born in France, so she couldn't get in too much trouble. But he has debated with the likes of Tariq Ramadan. I don't know if you know him. Many of your listeners will have heard of him, who just basically talked him under the table. He's a much, much better... how do I describe
writer that? Writer, the debater?
Not so much. Well, Medeb is actually very good on his feet. He has this radio program,
sure.
And but Tariq Ramadan is... I don't want to say he's slick, but he really knows... what language to use when he's talking to Westerners, which one to use when he's talking to Muslims. And he comes in his family. He comes from a long line of Muslim activists that and he knows his stuff. He's actually a Swiss citizen.
Okay. Let me invite listeners to join this conversation. This is a live program being broadcast today and in August of the year 2013. I say that because we have many people who download the program and listen to it at their own convenience on various electronic devices and computers, podcasts and all that. But if you are listening live, do give us a call. The numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 217-333-9455. So that will connect you to our good technical director, Kyle Kroa. She will answer the phone and put you in line to talk with our guest, Jane Kuntz. If you're calling long distance, do use an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. So in the 217 area code, punch in 333-WILL, long distance, 800-222-WILL. Well, happy to have conversation from listeners on this book, on the topics we're raising about translating such books. Let's talk a little bit, Jane, about what you did before the Peace Corps. Where did you grow up?
Oh, goodness. I grew up in Ohio. I was raised a Catholic. Went to Catholic schools, went to a Catholic college, St. Mary's College, Notre Dame. So I have a grounding in a faith, a very good grounding in a faith, which came in handy, as you know, as we were singing Beethoven's Missa Solemnis a couple weeks ago. That Latin just trips off my tongue. I have absolutely no problem with that.
Jane and I were singing in a choir in Utah, under the direction of a former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, who's now Dean of the Arts at the Utah State University and has pulled together a very large 170-member festival choir that did two performances of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. And we were part of a group of 30 who went from Champaign-Urbana out there to join this big choir and have sort of a workshop with the director. And it was quite a remarkable aesthetic experience.
It certainly was.
Would you say religious as well, spiritual?
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that because I don't have many occasions. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, and I don't go to church, haven't for a very, very long time. And hearing the Mass again in Latin, of course, reminds me of my childhood because Masses are no longer done in Latin.
In Latin.
So there was a certain nostalgia.
We have a caller waiting to join this conversation on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Good connection.
I would like to know from Jane, what were the greatest difficulties that you had in translating this work, Islam and the Challenge of Civilization? Just talk about a linguistic or cultural, or give us a sense of what some of the real challenges in this particular translating project you had.
Thank you. The challenges of the challenges of Islam.
I'm going to ring off here.
Okay,
that's fine.
Thank you.
You can list off the air. interesting.
Well, oddly enough, one of the problems is that Abdelhamedeb has a very sort of what they would call in French un style ampoulé. I shouldn't say that about him, but it's a very erudite style, and he goes about saying what he has to say in a kind of a roundabout way sometimes. So it was. As translators often have to do, we're not just translating meaning; we're doing a real mise en anglais. You know, we're putting it into the way Anglo-Saxon, you know, sentence structures should be, and
the way English speakers think.
The way English speakers think in the end, because sure. We think the way our language determines us to think in many ways. So my real task was to. Take his language and turn it into English sort of prose syntax, and that's not always easy. In the novel, it was a little more difficult because I didn't want to betray, as you know, the famous saying that says that all translators are traitors. I didn't want to betray the difficulty of that novel by simplifying it and saying, okay, here's basically what he wants to say. You can't do that with a novel. But in an essay, you can do that. And I have to say that my very talented editor at Dalkey will often correct me if I'm cleaving too close to French syntax. He can sniff that out right away. And my editor at Fordham did the same thing. When it looked like I was sticking too close to the French, he would call me on that. Whether or not I had difficulties culturally, I don't think so. I think Medib is talking about things that I'm quite familiar with, and if there was ever a bit of erudition there that I wasn't quite sure I was getting, it's so easy with the net now to go on and find out exactly, you know, what he means when he talks about Ibn Arabi's tendency to do this or that. You know, I can pretty much figure that out on my own. One of the challenges was the title. The title in French is Paris de Civilisation, and Paris, P-A-R-I, means, you know, a wager, you know, they call it the Paris de Pascal, you know, Pascal's wager, or a gamble, or a bet. And so trying to figure out exactly what that meant was a little difficult. It was the Fordham University Press's idea to call it Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. And, you know, publishers know which titles are going to work, so I couldn't argue with that. But we, in a sense, lost that idea of taking a risk for the sake of civilization, you know, going out on a limb, you know, betting on civilization as opposed to what Medeb calls this sort of uncivilized attitude of some Islamists in denying their own history and culture in favor of a more rigorous approach to Islam.
Let me follow up on that caller's question with another question about translating difficulties. You have in chapter 6 where he's talking about nature, a poem. And I noticed in the footnote it said that this was the author's translation. So that was Medeb's translation of that particular...
Right. He deals with a lot of... things that are yet to be translated into any language.
So he translated that from Arabic to French.
Right.
And then you translated that into English?
From French.
From
so
the French.
So I didn't go back to the original Arabic.
Sure.
I couldn't. And I wanted that to be made clear in case there is someone who knows the Arabic and who could go back and say, oh, Jane, that's not at all what the Arabic says. Well, I didn't have the Arabic in front of me. I had Abdelhamedeb's French translation. Now, I haven't gone back or asked anyone. But those are exactly the kinds of things that can trip up a translator.
Sure.
When we're already at a second and third degree from an original. I translated... a Romanian novel that was written directly into French. Romanians are often bilingual. And I often wondered, as I was translating this French into English, what was the Romanian that was sort of behind those French words? What would that have sounded like if it were in the author's other language, I'm assuming his mother tongue? And these are the mysteries of translation.
Let me follow that up with another quote from Medeb's book, Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. He has a couple appendices, and the first one is a dialogue. Mm. And in that dialogue, he says this. He's talking about God speaking from behind a veil. And he says, when God speaks, God does so outside the letters and sounds of our custom. And when such a message comes into a human language, it must be mediated through an angel. Passage through the veil requires translation.
Mm.
My question for you, Jane, is, are translators angels?
I've been called a lot of things, but never angelic.
But did you smile when you came to that bit of French?
Yes, yes. This is something that Medeb talks about in everything he's ever written, but especially now, because the concrete, banal veil is so much an issue, especially in France, where there are actually laws against its wearing.
Against Muslim women in school, for example,
yes,
wearing a veil.
Or in certain public places. Yes, the hijab or the niqab, which is even worse. That's the full veil
covering,
where only your eyes are shown. This notion of veil... language itself is a veil for Medeb. Meaning is always mediated through language, and language is opaque. And there are degrees of opacity of language, but it always is. And it is his view that the Quran, al-Karim, as they say, is itself a kind of veil. We will never see the deity. We will never see God. We can only see as if through a glass darkly. You know, we can only see through the mediation of human language. The Quran being one of the better examples of the highest examples of human language, but it still is a human language. And this gets to the issue of the created and the uncreated Quran. There are those who would claim that it was, you know, sent directly, that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is only he was only a vehicle for a Quran that came to him fully written and fleshed out. And there are others who say, of course not, it was a human production that evolved over a number of years and only came to its final form at a certain historical point that is easy to single out.
Now, that historical and literary criticism of the Quran is quite controversial, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, there are different Muslim categories of thought about that. And the Medeb is clearly in the part of using historical literary critical means to examine the Quran. And he makes a strong case for that in this book, Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. On the other hand, he, as you pointed out earlier, is sort of middle of the road in the sense that he sees great spiritual depth in the faith and in the Quran and in the history, and he is such a scholar of the history of Islam and the many footnotes in this book. Now, the book is very short, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 150 pages of text and then, you know, a couple of appendices and footnotes that go on for 15 pages or so. But it's even though it's a scholarly work, it's easily understandable, partly because of your good translation, I'm sure. It's accessible, and it makes the argument well, I think. And in today's headlines. I think it's very good for me to have read it, for example. Let's talk a little bit about what Appendix B says. Here, Medem has finished this book in 2009, and suddenly the first African-American president of the United States is in Egypt speaking in Cairo about, among other things, Islam. And were you involved in, of course, this book came out in French in 2009. Do you know about when he wrote these last little bits about Obama being in Cairo and Obama being elected?
I don't know the exact chronology of it. I know that he, like many, were very impressed with that speech, very surprised and very, very impressed by it. It was such a show of good faith, literally. He went to such, he meaning President Obama, went to such lengths to try to use the Quran in ways that could promote, you know, peaceful coexistence and such things that have become so hard to come by. Now, whether I would be very surprised if Medeb had such a high opinion of Barack Obama now. Many things have changed, and of course the drone strikes have embittered a lot of people against the United States policy. But at that time, when there was still a lot of goodwill flowing, what Medeb particularly appreciated, and he mentions this a lot throughout the book, is that Barack Obama made an effort to put into circulation what Medeb calls the Muslim reference. And by that he means references to not just the Quran but to Muslim culture in general that would allow people to have something other than the impression that they get from reading the headlines about the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, to get into common circulation references to architecture, to art, to beauty, to literature, to singers, to the glories of Muslim history, to current interesting efforts that are going on in all Muslim countries right now. He wants to get those into circulation. And what better way than to hear them in the mouth of an American president in a very, very high-profile speech? These are the sorts of things that Medeb has been trying to promote for decades now, both through his radio program, through his writings, his lecture tours. He's you can almost say that he's an activist for circulating the Muslim referent.
And Medeb chooses to end this book by quoting Obama, quoting the Quran, and saying that, yes, of course, there are parts of the Quran that can be quoted to justify killing of those who are your enemies, just like there are in the Christian Bible. But there's also parts like this, which Medeb quotes Obama quoting from the Quran, "Whoever killed a human being except as punishment for murder or other villainy in the land shall be deemed as though he had killed all mankind, and that whoever saved a human life shall be deemed as though he had saved all mankind." And Medeb goes on to say, by referring to this scriptural reference, the American president castigates violent elements among Muslims, those acting out of resentments.
Which surah is that?
I'm sorry?
Which surah is that?
That one I don't have marked. Sorry.
Okay.
I can't tell you. I know it's also quoted
just for the listeners
in 999, but I don't I don't remember this one. But Medeb ends this by, as you say, back in 2009, speaking very idealistically about his hopes for Obama and his leadership of the United States. And as you say, that's changed since then. But is this book that you translated as utopian, as Medem sort of was there for that moment in 2009 when he thought Obama was going to be leading a peaceful response to violence.
It is utopian, and I think he would be the first to admit that. First of all, it's a very erudite book. It doesn't get to the nuts and bolts of what might really be at the bottom of a lot of the rage, a word that's very often used with regard to Muslim-inspired uprisings. It's very often just quite simply economic. These are people who've been held down politically, economically, culturally, for generations, by leaders who don't always have their best interests in mind. And when all other projects have failed them, the socialists, the communists, the capitalists, you know, all these other, why not try an Islamic government? He doesn't really deal with that. That's not the purpose of his book. The purpose of his book is to bring back to the forefront an Islam that not only Muslims can and should be proud of, but one that Westerners will recognize if they try. Anyone who's ever been to Spain and who has eyes open can see what the glory years were, those times when Islamic civilization flourished in Andalusia. And this is the kind of message he's trying to get across. And there's something utopian about it, especially these days when everyone is, you know, more worried about security than about mutual understanding. But I think books like this, and, you know, he has also another book that's been translated by someone else into English called The Malady of Islam. And that one came out in the heat of post-9/11 anger among Muslims that their religion was being associated with this act. And he was trying to get to the bottom of that. It's another very interesting book to read.
Some of the things that I enjoyed so much about this book were his looking at the past and the contributions of Islam to philosophy, to the study of nature, to mathematics, to medicine, and the quotations he gave and showing the streams of who influenced whom. In Europe, for example, what the European thinkers and scientists were learning from what in Europe was later called the Dark Ages, but where Islam was flourishing. And Medem makes such a good case for architecture and literature and all of these other things that Islam really protected civilization, passed it on, was taking care of it from the time of the ancient Greeks and Romans until the Renaissance and until the Enlightenment. Mm. It's just a wonderful book, and yet he does it in a way, and through your translation, it comes across very well. It's, like I say, it's very readable. So thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's one of his great hobby horses to talk about, not in a naive way. Of course, he knows that all of this historical documentation has been handed down over centuries, and he can't speak with any absolute certainty about who did what. But he's very interested in this idea that the Arabs took the Greek, translated it into Arabic, passed it on where it was translated into Latin, and then got into circulation in Europe. But the point he also wants to make is it was never just simply translation. There it was added to. It was embellished. It was, you know, science was marching on, and the Arabs contributed and pursued what the Greeks had started, and their additions are much appreciated by scholars who are willing to admit that this is a subject of debate. Don't think that this goes those who would say that the Arabs were simply, as you said, they were just passing it on, you know, and and keeping things from being destroyed. But it wasn't, of course, it wasn't like that at all. There was history doesn't stand still, and these were great minds, not just Arabs, but Hindus, Persians.
He quotes them very effectively. We're down to our last 6 or 7 minutes of Keeping the Faith. We're live here at WLL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You can also hear this program at your convenience by going to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And I've been told that although this is our second to last Keeping the Faith program live here, that they will be kept in the archives for some time to come. So if you'd like to check with past programs or if you've missed part of this one, do go to that website and you'll be able to listen on various devices. Some of you know there is now a Will app, W-I-L-L app, where you can very easily hear these programs live at your convenience as you're traveling about with your little phones and other things. As well as through your computers. So the archives are available at that website. So let me give the phone numbers again. If you have a question for our guest, Jane Kuntz, who's the translator of Islam and the Challenge of Civilization, as well as Abdul Wahab Menib's earlier book, his novel, Talismano. She's our guest in the studio today. She's been a professor of French here at the University of Illinois, where she received her doctorate in French literature and has been a translator of a number of books. The phone number is 333-9455. If you're in the 217 area code, if it's long distance, 800-222-9455. If you're listening live in August of 2013, I'm Steve Shoemaker, usual host for these programs, and very glad to be talking with Jane about these books. Jane, there were some special translation problems with Talismano in that, as you sort of obliquely referred to, this book is a very strange novel and set at a time when he was young and he was experimenting with the novel form. And there's some words in this book we can't say on the radio. But that presents a problem for translators, because when you're talking about sexual things in a novel, what words do you use and how do you decide and how did you deal with that?
This is, I don't recall exactly which words you're referring to, but I think I know what you mean. Register is a very difficult thing in translation, because it means one thing in one language and another thing in another. And
Are you going to use medical terms? Are you going to use street language? Are you going to use
and
slang?
And whose street language and whose slang? Right.
And if you read something in French, what do you do in English?
Well, those are often decisions that have to be made with the editor, because they'll have a house policy on things like that. What you certainly don't want to do is, for instance, if there was some street urchins in Tangiers in Talismano using foul language, I didn't want to make them sound like America. No, but I didn't want to make them sound the way street kids, hip hop artists sound in the United States. In other words, I don't want to make that kind of transfer.
Cultural shift.
Right. Okay. So it's one of the great difficulties. You'd be surprised how often we end up just keeping the French word. And it works much, much better in some cases. I'm not going to use some words because we're on radio.
No, we can't.
But since we're on the subject of French, I just wanted to put in a little plug here for in this time when language departments are closing all over the country. I just read in Britain something like 40% of language departments are going to be closing down over the next 5 years in Britain. It's a terrible thing, and none of this would have happened to me. I wouldn't be sitting here in the studio. I wouldn't have gone to Tunisia ever if I hadn't, in high school, decided I was going to take French and then make it my major in college. Your option to take French, even as a minor, let's say you're an engineer. Okay, your minor is in French. You'd be very surprised where that can take you. And your orientation can suddenly be toward Francophone countries. Your sense of empathy, even, towards other French speakers will be enhanced. You get this almost sense of belonging to the whole language group that you are suddenly associated with. This is something that it's irreplaceable. It's only by learning a language that this magic can take place. And I'm putting a plug in here right now for any parents out there who are trying to decide whether their children should take foreign languages. Absolutely.
And the younger the better.
The younger the better. Exactly, exactly.
Right. We've been talking with Jane Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z, former professor of French at the University of Illinois. Now, you and your spouse, Richard Powers, are heading off to California soon.
You had to mention that.
Will you be translating things there?
I certainly hope so. Of course, translation is a job that you can carry with you in a suitcase, so I don't need to be any particular place. And I hope to be able to keep getting these connections, which are almost always serendipitous. I'm working on something right now, a Tunisian nonfiction book that just sort of fell into my lap thanks to a connection that I had already made at Stanford last year. So this is the way it works.
Well, I hope your time in Stanford goes wonderfully well, and I look forward to reading other books of yours that you translate in the future.
Thank you.
Jane is the translator of Islam and the Challenge of Civilization by Professor Medeb, M-E-D-D-E-B, published by Fordham Press just this year, and earlier a novel of his called Talismano. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. This is our very next-to-the-last program. Next week, we'll be having an archive program where Stan Yanchus, one of our guest hosts, interviewed both me and Don Nolan, another guest host, about the 14 years of this program. So if you'd like to indulge in a little nostalgia, do turn in next week. And the following week, WILO will be starting up again, The People's Pharmacy, here at this same time on Sunday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. I want to thank John Ellis, a tenor sax jazz player, who will be here at Krannert playing with Dr. Lonnie Smith on September 10th. If you don't have tickets for Lonnie Smith, you can hear our wonderful tenor sax player, John Ellis, playing with him on that date, if he makes it back from Tokyo, where he's playing with another group for 3 days before that. But that's coming up at Krannert. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our region features a remarkable number of talented musicians playing almost countless types of acoustic music, as well as artists in the realms of theater and dance. Live and Local lets you know who's playing where and when, with good conversation, great music, recordings by local artists, and frequent live performances in our studio. We broadcast the show 5 days a week at 4 p.m., just before All Things Considered. Please join me for Live and Local, only on FM 90.9.
Up next, Ira Glass and This American Life. This week, stories of people doing the noble thing and stepping up to help, only to find out that others think what they're doing isn't helping at all. Thanks for spending some of your weekend with us. I'm Jason Croft, and you're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana, and streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Coming up in an hour, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Don't go anywhere.